Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 132 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, holy cow, good to see you again.
Good to see you, man.
Another fun week.
It's like, it's not dull anymore.
I feel like earlier this year we had gone through like a couple of months of like boring stuff, and now it's just nonstop crazy stuff or big news happening every single week. And when you think it can't be, it's got to calm down at some point. It doesn't stop. It's wild right now.
It's definitely wild. And like, you know, some stuff you can see coming, and then sometimes, you know, the president has an assassination attempt out of the blue. And sometimes the Japanese yen carry trade unwinds over the weekend and everything crashes, and then everything snaps back real quick. And then we're back to normal, like it never happened.
Yeah, it's wild. And I mean, so one of the things that's been ongoing for 4 years has been this whole XRP issue with the SEC. And that just got finalized, right? So this past week, we're talking about 4 years of SEC issues that have come to an end. They have settled for $125 million civil penalty, which is 94% less than the $2 billion that the SEC wanted for Ripple selling improperly to institutional investors, right? And now they've officially declared that XRP is not a security now, and especially if you sell it on the secondary market, it's not an issue at all for consumers. So that's huge news from an overall crypto perspective on another token that is not a security.
Yeah, I think that's good news for the XRP guys specifically, and good news for the rest of the industry for sure. If you're the SEC, you have to start thinking, oh, these guys aren't going to just settle. We can't just wrap them up in a lawsuit and expect them to settle and push them around. Like, this crypto industry is better funded and likes to fight. And oh, by the way, we are getting beat every single time. I mean, to me, this is $125 million. XRP, I don't know how much money they spend on legal fees, but it's probably more than that over 4 years. So, I mean, it's getting kind of ridiculous that these regulators are still pushing. I maybe it's just they've got a cognitive dissonance problem where they think they're right. And no matter how many times they're told they're wrong, they continue to think they're right. Like, I don't know where we go from here, but if they keep filing lawsuits and you know, kind of trying to push this industry around, they're going to continue to lose. So I don't, it just doesn't make sense anymore. They need to pump the brakes and evaluate, because how many resources are they wrapping up in these lawsuits? You know, I think in the past with traditional investing firms and things like that and companies, they just settle with the SEC because they don't want the fight. But the crypto guys like the fight because they're winning so much. So the SEC's got to lick their wounds here soon and start to reevaluate how they're going to try to push regulations.
Would help if they actually just made some sort of framework for what to expect, other than saying the laws are good now, and yet everybody that's fought it has beat the SEC on what the laws say, because it doesn't make sense. And the rest of the world is going through right now and making new laws that are specific to digital assets. But
yeah, the court system is basically telling them the laws aren't good enough. Yeah. You're wrong. Do something. And, you know, whether that's Congress or the regulators, nobody's really doing anything. Well, that's not true. Nothing has been done yet. Some things may start happening.
To be crazy, I mean, the SEC is definitely a big problem, but so the U.S. Federal Reserve Board just went after another bank here recently, too. So Customers Bank, which is probably one of the last crypto-friendly banks, they came out and said they have significant deficiencies with their AML laws. So I think what a lot of people are saying is that this whole choke point 2.0 is still happening, and it's not just the SEC that's trying to kill the crypto industry. It is also the Federal Reserve Board, which is really a bunch of banks.
Yeah. In addition to that, on the exact same lines, so they had a little round table with White House officials, not Kamala, but White House officials and industry leaders. And it got heated because they, when they were speaking about the SEC and regulations, the White House officials weren't listening to them when it came to like banking being choke point 2.0, having trouble. And so the crypto industry guys are like, all right, raise your hand if you've had problems banking. And everybody raised their hand. And I think like, there's just such a huge disconnect between the government and the industry right now. And at least they're sitting down and talking about it. Like that's like, I mean, you and I got into this 7 years ago. This is like the first time I've heard of a meeting. And you and I, we do quite a bit of business. If you have a misunderstanding, emails don't work. Text messages don't work. You got to get on a call and talk it out. And it takes a while. And you got to start to understand the other side's position. And you got to start figuring out a solution that's acceptable for both sides. I mean, you know, that stuff doesn't happen with just a couple of words and things and tweets and things like that. So at least they're starting to talk. But it was like the first time that the White House officials were able to even consider that what they're hearing is true, that it's difficult to get things done because the regulations are so screwy.
Yeah. So the good news is this was the second meeting they've had, and the people that showed up are the most senior representatives from kind of more of the Biden administration, right? Since the Harris administration doesn't really exist yet. So it's still the right people.
But so I said White House. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who's in charge. The White House is, you know, so
probably
anyway.
Probably neither one of them.
Right? I know who's not in charge.
Yeah. So, what I read is those advisors got blasted by the crypto industry. They went off on them pretty much saying how much damage that they've done to the crypto industry because of their regulations that they put in place. And what's interesting is Harris is actually, I guess, assignings or getting some new advisors on her end, which I think they're coming from the Treasury Department and somewhere else that's kind of been in the crypto industry, which the scary part about it is Elizabeth Warren is thrilled about the two people that she's assigned, which to me is always a red flag if Elizabeth Warren is saying something good about it. But yeah, so I mean, it's at least heading in the right direction. And shoot, if you look at Polymarket, Harris has actually taken the lead over Trump, 52% to 46%. So, but what's crazy is now the CFTC is trying to ban all prediction markets. So even like everybody is using Polymarket to get their news, I feel like, and the CFTC wants to ban it all. Luckily, the Coinbases and a bunch of other crypto giants are fighting it. So, because it's too much of just a broad paint stroke of saying prediction markets are bad, we got to get rid of them. When that's, I think they're really just worried about political prediction markets more than anything else.
I saw that too, and I was like, well, when everybody's lying all the time and you can't trust any media source that you have, go look where people put their money.
Yeah,
that's the only really kind of signal you can get. Like polls seem to be garbage ever since the 2016 election. So who's betting what, like, you know, and who's got some more information? Where's the money going? So I think if you ban Polymarket, like it's just another freedom of speech issue. I mean, it's like, where am I supposed to get my information from if I can't see where people are betting?
Yeah. So speaking of where the money's being put, we've talked about Fairshake being one of the super PACs in the past. They have just announced they're going to spend $25 million on teen races throughout the U.S. 9 Republicans and 9 Democrats. They recently have just gotten rid of another Warren ally, I think in Missouri. And over the summer, the people they spent money on, 33 of the 35 times.
Pretty good record.
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of it has, what I've been reading is they have definitely jumped on board with some of the, well, I would say the pro-Israel groups have helped out quite a bit because they're spending more money than the crypto people are. Yeah. But, and that's apparently a bigger deal in certain places. But yeah, it's still, they are making sure that the Senate will have some more crypto-friendly people there in the future. And it won't take many to get to that majority needed to overturn certain things like SAB 121 and things like that.
Well, not only that, I mean, with crypto and Bitcoin, you get one guy in there, one girl in there, and 4 years later, there's five. And then those, say four of those five stick around. And then 4 years later, there's 16. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, it's this, it's why the, my thesis on why Bitcoin is going to be successful is like every 4 years, there's two times as many people or more that are shifted from either against Bitcoin to neutral or from neutral to some level of adoption. And so if you actually start to grease the wheels a little bit on this and you start to pump some money into these election campaigns, or a different issue comes up and it just so happens that the people that are on one side of that issue are also pro Bitcoin and crypto, then if you accelerate this at all, it goes real fast. Like, you skip some of the shallow part of the adoption curve. And I think that's what happened with COVID and inflation. It opened a lot of people's eyes up to money. And once you start to realize that maybe it's not that stocks and real estate and goods and services are all at an all-time high, it's that the dollar is at an all-time low, then you start thinking, okay, well, if the dollar's no good, what else is there? And then you can at least lead yourself to Bitcoin a little bit. So you start to accelerate the adoption of Bitcoin. It didn't need help. Like, it was doing pretty good. 15 years, let's back up 4 years, 10, 11 years since its launch. And it's got to guys like me and you, tens of millions of people are into it. And then you freak out the entire global economy and start to crush various fiat currencies. Now, in the previous 4 years, we've shot through the roof. I mean, we got Trump and RFK speaking at the Bitcoin conference, you know, and you do finally have some people following the MicroStrategy campaign on the corporate side. So that's starting to get some legs. And different, you know, El Salvador could have been the only country for a long time. I would have to think if countries aren't already stockpiling Bitcoin, they're going to start really soon. So yeah, I mean, you start putting some legislators in place, even if it is a handful right now, they're going to start talking to people and get people on their side and have like-mindedness where you grow on that side. And then next election, you're going to get even more. But just because the general population has more, and it kind of opens your eyes a little bit, not just to the money side, but to the government side. And then you start to think, okay, well, if I'm going to do something important, I might as well go to Washington and try to get something done. So to me, you know, it seems like crypto and Bitcoin moves fast and government moves slow. So you kind of only get a kick at the can every 4 to 6 years, depending on, you know, House or Senate. But you every 4 to 6 years, this thing grows, and then it's a kind of a step change as far as the elections go.
Yeah. I mean, if you look outside the US, it's been growing like crazy just because of governments in most of the world right now are crazy and cutting back on freedoms for a lot of their citizens. And shoot, you could argue that's happening here in a certain aspect, right? But it's the problem has been, and in especially El Salvador, everything you read about there is El Salvador has jumped into it, but their government has said, yeah, this is a great thing to do. And it has a bunch of their citizens saying, wait a minute, if government's saying it, should we really be doing this?
Fair point.
Yeah. So I think just the education piece is so hard to get over on everybody. And where do you get that education from? And usually it's a one-to-one kind of thing. It's not a one-to-many. It's, you have to start and almost hold somebody's hand to get them through that first part of it. And then they go from there, right? It's just because the government says something doesn't mean that it's actually going to proliferate across the entire country.
No, that's fair. But a little bit at a time, and then things just accelerate it. So, you know, we've been watching this for a long time, and it's getting kind of over the first few hurdles is very difficult. And then after that, things get so much easier. So, you know, the game theory side of it, plus just the, you know, there's an element of this where people see their net worth increase in dollar terms. That's really attractive. You know, I don't think people in Washington like the other people in Washington getting ahead of them in net worth terms. So you know, there's, you can kind of play on that too. So yeah, I'm all for it, man. Like, if you give me one more Bitcoiner in Congress, I'll take it. If you give me five, I would love it.
Well, I mean, you look at what happened last week with this, we've had the largest drop in over 2 years in crypto, and Ethereum ETFs were, what, 3 weeks old, 2 weeks old, whatever it was. Holy cow. All they did was buy the dip. Nobody was selling. BlackRock ended up, I think they had over $900 million of inflows in about 2 weeks, which now puts them in the top six ETFs of 2024 after 2 weeks. The five above that, four of those five were Bitcoin spot ETFs.
Like, you know, it's not often you get to see a new asset class get exposed to the market. I mean, I think emerging markets were the last asset class to kind of jump in. That was a long time ago. So you're talking about something pretty neat. And it's also happening at a time where if you've got new money on the sidelines, what are you going to do? Are you going to buy stocks when they're through the roof? Or, you know, you got seven stocks that are really doing well and you're going to keep piling into those. So I think that's good. And yeah, I looked at the inflows and outflows after in this dip. I mean, this was a substantial impact to the Bitcoin and crypto price, and Bitcoin ETFs held pretty steady. I think they might have been up on the week or very close to neutral. Pretty solid for getting smashed on a Sunday night. So I like to see that. I like this. And we had a $6,500 daily candle after that crash. And everybody in crypto or Bitcoin, you know, talked about this Omega candle, $10,000 in a day candle. And I'm like, man, you're 65% of the way there. You know, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. And just if you look at the wick on that candle the day after the crash, it dipped all the way down to like 49, but it closed way up. So, you know, there was a ton of buying pressure in crypto and Bitcoin when the price dropped. There's a lot of buyers. That's a good sign. So I don't like it, but it's kind of a good little stress test to let you know what the sentiment of the market is.
Yeah. Well, shoot, you look at the ETFs still, and what's crazy is they're kind of playing with like a broken leg, right? I mean, they don't have any of the in-kind creation or redemption like Hong Kong does. Mm-hmm. There's no options trading on any of the spot ETFs, which I think may be coming soon. And then there's no staking allowed on Ethereum, right? So, which is allowed the rest of the world pretty much. So, I mean, you have kind of this one arm tied behind your back, and the ETFs are still becoming some of the best ETFs so far this year. So, I mean, it's definitely going well. And I think New York Stock Exchange and then Bitwise and Grayscale just proposed on trading options on Ethereum on the ETF. So they have another 21 days of comments left, but it sounds as if, I mean, this is something they've been trying to do on the Bitcoin spot ETF for a while. And that theoretically is supposed to happen before the end of the year. Now, Ethereum probably will follow shortly after that, but it went from not moving at all to all of a sudden regulation has changed a bit and they're starting to look at, okay, maybe we should take a look at this.
Yeah. And you know, if you start to goose this thing by allowing staking in the Ethereum ETFs, if you're an investment financial advisor kind of person, and okay, well, you've got the Bitcoin ETF, blah, blah, blah. You've got the Ethereum ETF that has this staking, which is just effectively a dividend. You know, I mean, like they can, you don't have to know anything about anything beyond the words Ethereum and staking from an investment vehicle standpoint. You know, like it's super parallel for them, and they don't care. Like, honestly, the vast majority of these guys don't really care what Ethereum is or whether you build on or whatever. They care if the price goes up and does it kick off cash flows. And if it does, they've got clients that like to get 2-4% and see price escalation. So that's something they can sell. So I know that Bitcoin and crypto people don't want to hear that people are in it just for the money and not for all of the philosophical goodness that comes along with being into crypto. But the fact is, most people don't care. Most people are super busy working their day job and then trying to figure out how to retain their wealth in their spare time. And oh, by the way, raise kids and do everything else. So, you know, not everybody's built the same, but this does allow everybody to get a piece of it and kind of ride the wave. So I don't view it as a bad thing at all.
Yeah, I was reading. So Morgan Stanley, I guess, announced last week that they were going to start letting their 15,000 advisors sell the spot Bitcoin ETF. And there was an old SEC chair of some sort that came on and said, this is a death wish for Morgan Stanley because the SEC is so anti-digital assets that they're going to come after them and try to get every single email they've ever done. I kind of laughed. I was like, huh, sounds familiar. That's what Coinbase is trying to do to the SEC right now. So it'll be interesting to kind of see what happens. But now all of a sudden they're saying, I think UBS and Bank of America are supposed to follow Morgan Stanley here very shortly, within months, I guess, and allow their asset managers to sell the spot Bitcoin ETF too, right? So it kind of goes back to that game theory. Once somebody does it, everybody's going to have to, or else they're going to fall behind.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a real death wish for Morgan Stanley, except for everybody else is going to do it too, and they can't go after everybody. And in fact, once a couple more people go in, their opinion of it is going to change because all of their advertisers and all of their lobbyists and like everybody's coming behind them. So yeah, it's just, I just can't imagine being a person that doesn't see it. You know, once you see it, once you can tell like, oh, here we go. The Morgan Stanley fell. There goes that domino. It's only a matter of time before it strikes the next domino. And then, oh, by the way, those dominoes hit dominoes that are outside of that industry. And so, I mean, the finance committee and the bank, there's people inside of government that are pro Bitcoin or neutral that are on the finance committee. So you got one guy in that room. All you need is one guy in the room. And it just takes time before there's two or three. And so to not be able to tell that, or to be able to say that stuff out loud, because how often, like, I hate being wrong, right? I don't know if it's just an engineer thing. And like, I'm like, man, if I'm wrong, if I get a bolt wrong, maybe the bridge collapses, right? I hate being wrong. These people just don't seem to give a crap of whether they're right or wrong, and they just say stuff. And how can you not leave the door cracked for, hey, Morgan Stanley, they're taking a risk here. You know, they're sticking their neck out being the first big guys to really jump into this Bitcoin crypto world. But I can see why they do it, because the branch that they're standing on is getting thicker and thicker as the ETFs gain more and more popularity and more funds flow in. And oh, by the way, they have a shareholder responsibility to do what's best for the fiduciary position of the shareholders. And if everybody else is making money and you're not, you're kind of in violation of your fiduciary responsibility. So I mean, it just, it's like a looking glass thing. Once you're on the other side of it, it's so easy to see. And I guess if you're not on the other side of it, you just can't see it.
Well, to me, it seems as though it is mostly an age issue, right? So if you are very old, which a lot of people in Congress are, and very set in their ways, they're almost not willing to learn anything else. And shoot, I have this conversation with my father-in-law all the time where we talk about this, and he's like, I just don't understand it. And I was like, well, I mean, have you read the white paper? Like, have you taken any time to go understand it? He's like, no. And I was like, you're retired. You have nothing else to do. Go spend 30 minutes or even less reading the white paper. And if it's interesting, you can go spend a couple hours a week and learn a little bit more on whether or not this makes sense. And he's like, well, I'm past where I care about understanding that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, that's a problem. You can't make decisions if you don't spend the time to understand why one is good or bad.
No, listen, man, I've had this thought before too. So say you're 70, right? That seems to be between 60 and 80 seems to be the number. So say you're 70, you're born in 1954. You know how much stuff you saw happen and all these changes that you made that you didn't bother to understand? Like, you didn't figure out the internet, you know? Like, you didn't, I don't know how email works, so I'm going to keep sending these letters, right? So you didn't do that.
People still can't figure that out, but that's a whole other issue.
Yeah, well, they figured out how to type, even if they aren't like really good at it. Yeah. They don't know how that works. I mean, it's unbelievable that how important it is to understand crypto and Bitcoin, but how unimportant it is to understand anything else you use. Nobody understands how a microwave works, right? They didn't have a microwave. Like 1954 is pre-microwave, I think, right? Yeah. So you're talking about like almost everything that has developed in their lifetime, they didn't bother to understand, and they still use it, except this thing that makes the most sense. Now, it's more abstract. I'll give them that. Like a microwave, oh, you push start, it works, my food gets hot, it's done. But with Bitcoin, it's like, yeah, you send money to people, they value it, you value it, you exchange the value, and you're done. So maybe it is. Maybe it's like daisy chaining misunderstandings or daisy chaining, like, I don't understand how email works or the internet works. So Bitcoin is like a derivative of the internet. So it's even further removed, but it's just, it's wild. I can't imagine seeing all this innovation in your lifetime and then being like, no, this one, no thanks. This is where I get off. This is where I'm not along for the ride anymore.
It's not even trying. It's just saying, oh, whatever I hear the talking head on TV say, that must be right, without ever looking into it to know, to form my own opinion, I feel like what they're doing, which is super frustrating. Because I think my view is, if you're not learning every single day, you're pretty much dying at this point, right? And we've hit this exponential curve with technology that you're going to have to continue to learn if you want to survive, right? And it doesn't mean you have to become an expert. You just have to know enough to be able to survive at this point. And if you don't stop learning, you're not going to be able to survive long term.
Yeah. And these talking heads that they listen to on TV are the same ones that have been lying to them that they don't trust when it comes to anything else.
and they don't know what they're talking about most of the time. You listen to them, you're like, what are they even saying? This is so wrong.
Yeah. I mean, if they were good at math, they wouldn't be a journalist.
So speaking of changing their opinions, by the way, I don't know if you saw the IRS, but they have changed their tax form plan. Now, we had talked a while ago about this revision of the tax form was going to create a need for everybody to put every individual wallet address into the tax form so that they could track what you were doing. Luckily, they've removed that, right? So you do not have to put all your wallet addresses. I think we joked that there are people who are going to put 10,000 wallet addresses on there just to fuck with them. But that's not going to happen now. There's still probably some issues from the DeFi perspective. They don't really have that worked out. And that's kind of a big deal, especially since it's kind of going to compete with the banks, that the banks are becoming more and more difficult to work with. So DeFi could actually take off here if the banks don't figure out how to become easier to deal with the crypto community. We'll see.
Yeah, I did see that, and it was like, yep, this is exactly what I said was going to happen, man. It's like impossible to deal with. And so, yeah, these when you don't know what you're talking about, you create some rule or law or whatever, and then find out, oh, this was a bad idea. You know, it's like, hey, let's make sure everybody's reporting $600 or more in every single monetary software and app that there is. And then we'll let the IRS deal with it. And it's like, hey, guys, it's every single person in the United States above whatever age allows these apps to happen. I mean, hey, newsflash, the $600 limit has been in place since like the 70s, and it's not indexed to inflation. So it should be like $10,000. So newsflash, guys, like, you can't just live on the periphery, and you can't make rules with a surface level knowledge. And so, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much exactly what it says. Like, just don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. As much as we like to think the U.S. is ahead of the curve and innovation in general, countries like Thailand have just announced their SEC has created a regulatory sandbox to facilitate crypto testing on real-world experiments. Right. So it would be great if the SEC in the U.S. was all about that, instead of just saying, oh, yeah, you want to do something with crypto, we're probably going to send you a Wells notice and maybe fine you $2 billion.
The more other countries do that, even if it's on a small scale, even if it doesn't really move the needle in the industry, I think it does move the needle for the awareness of the federal government to start to understand that they're inhibiting the industry.
And Brazil just came out, and Brazil's been pretty much a pretty pro-crypto country for a while now. They have finally launched Solana ETFs. So the thought is that Solana ETFs in the U.S. could be coming soon if Brazil is doing it on their end now too.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like World War II. Like there needs to be a crypto Pearl Harbor moment where it's like everybody in the United States realizes, oh, we don't have a choice. Like the rest of the world is going here, and if we get in, we can do it our way, or if we sit on the sidelines, then we're in trouble. Things are going to happen whether we play or not. And so, you know, I don't know what that looks like. Some other country comes out with something very successful, and then we're trying to catch up or something like that. But it's, you don't get to choose whether or not this industry moves forward. You get to choose whether or not you are involved. And right now we're choosing to just really kind of tread water with it, and something will happen and we'll hit the gas. Like, it's just, some of these people just can't dodge a punch, right? We see the guy rearing back. We see this coming at our face. And like, these people are just like, it's probably not going to hit us. This thing will go away. I don't believe this is going to happen. And then next thing you know, you're like, oh, okay, I'm in a fight now. I saw it coming. I just didn't move. And now it's like, whether I want to or not, I'm going to have to engage. So we'll get there eventually. Just hopefully we do it sooner so that we're not in too bad of a position.
Yeah, which is kind of, I feel like, what Nigeria is doing now. So Nigeria used to be one of the leading countries in the world with crypto adoption. And they've kind of overturned that and banned crypto in general. There's a crypto advocate over there that has filed a lawsuit against almost all of Nigeria, the SEC, the central bank, the police force, and like three other government agencies to overturn the crypto ban and make Bitcoin a commodity. So, I mean, it's a big deal where he's saying that right now there's no access to crypto for the citizens, and he wants to change that. So I'll be interested to see what happens with that. I mean, at the same time, you have Tygen in jail in Nigeria, and man, it is a mess, right? I mean, he needs a specialized back surgery. He's had so many throat infections that he has to get his tonsils removed. He's on blood thinners because he's in a bed the entire time. He had to be pushed in a wheelchair to the last hearing. His next hearing isn't for almost 2 months, like October 11th, and he's not allowed to access his lawyers. So it's a mess. And one of those things, I mean, we've been talking about the U.S. government to try to do something to get him back. And I think there's been the Senate or the House has gone over there and tried to do something, but it hasn't happened. So if the U.S. is going to do something soon, they probably need to do it before he doesn't make it back, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's like, oh, this is a back burner problem until it's on the front burner and, mm-hmm. and it's boiling over. So if we don't do something soon, it's going to be a big problem. And this administration seems to just be very reactive and rather than proactive. And whether it's border problems or things like this, it's like, we'll just wait until it blows up. And maybe that's in a day or a year, but things blow up. I mean, it's you're just waiting for it to happen.
Yeah, some other news. We were talking about Brazil launching Solana ETFs. Grayscale decided to launch a couple of trusts now too. BitTensor and Sui. So BitTensor is probably one of the top AI coins out there, and Sui is another smart contract layer one that are still pretty new, and I like both of them. I think they're both really intriguing, so it's exciting to see that Grayscale is launching those. What will happen with them? Who knows at this point, right? But it's good to see that Grayscale, I mean, I think they're up to like 18 different crypto trusts or crypto products that they have access to here. So they're still kind of pushing the innovation forward with crypto and trust / funds of some sort. So that's exciting to see.
Well, they're not very good at ETFs. So maybe maybe they could stick to the trusts and make some money that way. I did see that ETH finally had a day of neutral close. So after 10 days of trading, they stopped bleeding at least for a day. So that's something. But yeah, Grayscale's 2.5% fees and things like that work on a closed end of the fund where nobody else, where you don't have any other options. But once you have another option, it's pretty much over.
Yep. So Solana is also starting to get a ton of activity in general on their blockchain, but the DePIN projects, the decentralized physical infrastructure. So there is a company called Andrema. They just got about $18 million in financing to do what they're calling a DAME, decentralized autonomous wireless network, which is kind of cool. I'll be interested to see how that happens, but it would just allow people that have nodes connecting to the internet to provide a way to have a wireless network without having to jump through the hoops of dealing with a wireless network company these days.
Yeah, man, like, try it. I feel like this is one of those things where there's enough smart people work on enough different projects, then some of them work. And do I view my wireless network to be a huge headache for me? Not really, but yeah, some people do. And if you can take that headache away, then you have a use case.
I don't think it's mainly focused on the U.S., to be honest with you. I think this is like a Mexico and Africa and other remote locations type thing is where they're focused on. So it's, I mean, we talked about it, just trying new things is great, right? So exciting to see somebody try new things, and we'll see where it goes. This is still pretty early, but Solana has gotten a ton of other deep end projects on board on Solana that are making interesting progress in their space. So I'll be interested to see what happens here too.
Yeah. Yeah. I will let you talk to me about it every week.
And then I think the last thing that I had was just some interesting real world asset news. So Franklin Templeton has a US government money market fund, FOBXX, that they just launched on Arbitrum as well. So they had already been on Polygon and Stellar. Now it's on Arbitrum, which is the layer two for Ethereum. They have about $430 million in assets as of the end of their last quarter, which makes them the second largest real world asset, I guess, in the world at this point, right? So BlackRock having the largest one at this point. But exciting to see that they're expanding onto other blockchains. And it's interesting because Polygon is a layer two on Ethereum. Going to Arbitrum, another layer two on Ethereum, they're just saying that, hey, Ethereum is here to stay, and we want to have access to all the different blockchains out there, and we'll see if it continues to go to more. But Arbitrum is one of those that very low fees, very fast transactions. So now you can access that anywhere in the world, anytime. So when people need liquidity on a Sunday night from whatever they did in Japan, they could get access to this, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like that. I think that you'll start to see some of these stock trading platforms expand their trading hours. You know, after that thing on Sunday, now that the crypto and Bitcoin's big enough to get on people's radar and they can see, like, okay, there's a problem in a different time zone, US players are locked out, I think you'll see that liquidity be too attractive. So I think they'll probably figure out a way to start expanding those hours. Also, I mean, you just got to keep up. I mean, the stock market wants funds flowing into them as well, and the ETFs and Bitcoin ETFs are not traded, you know, on a Sunday night. So I'm curious to see if that kind of pushes the tokenization of stocks and things like that we've touched on before, and allows things to open up a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think having everything tokenized will change the velocity of money, the way things move around, and the freedom to be able to access it at any time. So Larry Fink is a huge believer in it. He thinks everything's going that way. We'll see how quickly it takes to get there. I mean, $430 million is not a lot of money considering how much money is in stock markets and derivatives at this point, but it's at least a start.
Right.
What else did I miss? Anything else we needed to cover?
Two things that I had on my radar. One, the MicroStrategy 10-to-1 split to go, I mean, whatever they were trading at, $1,300. So they're now trading at $100, but you have 10 times the shares. I think, you know, what Michael Saylor does, well, I mean, one, it's pretty obvious. It's like, hey, $1,300 is expensive. Is it really going to go to $2,600? That seems like a big jump. $130 to $260 doesn't seem like that difficult compared to the other way, which is really dumb, but that's just the way it is. But on the other side of that, you know, the MicroStrategy convertible notes allows fixed income to get exposure to Bitcoin. And a stock with a $1,300 price really is tough in the options market because you're having to buy a minimum of 100, you know, 100 shares when you're buying an option. So, you know, it just makes everything really expensive. on a per transaction basis. So by cutting it by 90%, now your option, you have more people able to get into the options market. And so I don't know if that's the reasoning behind that change or what, but it definitely is a side effect of making that move.
Well, it's also for those people putting money into a 401k or some sort of qualified plan every week or 2 weeks or whatever month. This gives them the ability to buy a stock, a share of stock, rather than having to save up for X number of weeks before they can buy it. So it does make it all easy. And I mean, in reality, this is what almost every company in the world out there does today. Maybe it's not a 10-to-1 split, but stock splits happen constantly in the world. So I feel like everybody you talk to, you can, whatever company you're talking to, you can almost guarantee that it's had a stock split at some point. So you look at their price, what you can't usually easily determine is how many stock splits they've had. So that their actual price is really a lot higher from a rate of increase than what you've seen.
Yep. And then on the other side, I listened to a podcast with a Van Eck guy, and this was a couple of weeks old. It's like they didn't release it very quickly because it was pre-Ethereum ETF release. But he said it looks like, you know, 80% retail, 20% institutions so far in the ETFs, which would be wildly bullish, right? I mean, we're in the whatever it is, $15 to $20 billion of inflow, and we haven't seen institutions come in almost any way, or in very small ways. So it's really just a latent retail demand that is finally allowed to jump in and convert their 401ks or do whatever. So to me, that was great news from a funds flowing in standpoint. And it backs what we've talked about since January, that it's just going to take these institutions a long frickin' time to get their stuff together and get themselves into the ETFs. I mean, Morgan Stanley, I mean, it's August, right? So that's 7 months for Morgan Stanley to open it up to people that have $1.5 million and a high risk tolerance. You know, it's still not wide open at Morgan Stanley. So next 3 to 6 months, we'll see these guys kind of start to move in. Next 3 to 6 months happens to coincide with when we normally see the hyperbolic bull price run start. So until the cycles don't happen, I've got to think the cycles happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Kathy Wood had pretty much said, is that the wirehouses were their biggest customers. And when everything turned on in February, she said, I don't expect really much to happen for 6 months until those guys start to make some changes. And shoot, last week was the first time that Morgan Stanley has made one, and it's still just a small percentage of their total base, right? I mean, it is a large amount of assets because it's the guys that hold a lot of money, but it's still, they're not opening it up to everybody. And so there's still a long ways to go from an institutional perspective to get to, I think, where we really see the banana zone.
Yeah. And I mean, to make a callback, you know, those high net worth people are typically 60 to 80 years old. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, some of that money can come in just, I mean, even if they just get convinced to allocate 1 to 4% or something, you know, just a small nominal amount. That's a lot of money when you start getting everybody else in there. And it doesn't take much to move the needle when you're in the low 1 trillion market cap range. So, you know, we're in August, so we're getting close to when I would expect to see some price movement. Now, it is kind of funky because we're kind of in a fear category on the fear and greed scale, and we're at $60,000 of Bitcoin. You know, we just flushed a lot of leverage longs in that dip down to 49. And so the setup's pretty bullish from where we can go right now. And you know, we just need the money to start coming in.
Yeah. So at the last time we were at that type of fear level, we were at what, sub 20K Bitcoin? It's gone above 60 now and come back down, and it's at that same level, and now we're at 60. So should we expect another triple or so from here? That'd be great, right?
But yeah, another triple makes sense. It'll just take a little while.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, a fun, exciting week. I can't wait to see what's going to happen next week.
I agree, man. Like every week, something historic happens. So we'll see what happens in the next 7 days.
Perfect. Well, great talking to you, Hal. We'll chat again next week.
Sounds good, man. Good to see you.
Yeah.
If all of these
crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.